Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There may be more men in Shakespeare's plays, many more, but the Bard's women pack a punch. Tina Packer has been playing and directing Shakespeare's women for 40 years, learning them from the inside out, putting Shakespeare's feminine side on stage. Now she's brought the female roles together in her new work, Women of Will. It's a powerful will. This hour on Point, the women of William Shakespeare. You can join the conversation. Who intrigues you most among the Bard's female characters? Rosalind or Lady Macbeth or Ophelia or Juliet or someone else? Can he who tamed the shrew also deliver the goods on women, on what women know? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio, and it's great to have her here, is Tina Packer, founder and artistic director of Shakespeare & Company, the renowned theater group in Lenox, Massachusetts. She's one of America's premier Shakespeareans, hails from England, where she began her career. She's completed a five-part series of plays that gathers many of those roles, calls it her ring cycle. This summer, she's condensed all of that work into Women of Will, following the feminine in Shakespeare's plays. It's an overview, kind of a summary of her great work. That play premiered in March in Colchester, England, and will run through July 24th in Lenox, Massachusetts. You can see more information at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins me now in the studio. Tina Packer, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
It's so great to have you here. I look at you and I see multitudes. You're embodying all these women. 177, is that your count?
It depends on how you count them. I mean, are fairies and witches women, or is Ariel a man or a woman, you know?
So up against 770 men.
Thereabouts.
Depending how you count.
Yes.
It's not a fair contest in sheer numbers, but you're right. That Shakespeare's art, that artistry itself has something profoundly feminine about it. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you just take what are normally called the feminine qualities, which are, you know, the intuitive qualities, the idea that you're working out of feeling, that you're more interested in relationships, you might notice those are all the things that an artist needs. So what an artist needs is to be able to take leaps of faith and not know why he or she is doing what they're doing, but will do it, and it comes out of their unconscious minds, and you'll put it out there and see what comes up and create out of that. You're working in feeling, intuition, feeling, this kind of visceral knowledge is what an artist works out of, and it is also what women work out of. I'm generalizing because, of course, you know, any good man has a lot of masculine any good man has a lot of feminine qualities. Any good woman worth her salt's going to have masculine qualities.
And you're certainly bold as an interpreter of Shakespeare, as a director, as an actor. The bold side, there's plenty of it. As a feminist at the same time, and I think you'd count yourself that way. I mean, looking back over all these 400 years, I mean, maybe none of us can judge him. We sort of all live in Shakespeare's world, in the English-speaking world. But sort of your big assessment, I mean, how did he do with women? Was he as good with women as he was in his insight and his understanding as he was with men?
Well, no, when he was very young, of course, he projected onto women, just like any 18-year-old probably does. You know, in the early plays, they're either virgins and very sweet and stuck on pedestals, or they're vulvas with teeth, you know.
Ah,
I mean, they're
watch out.
Shrews that have got to be tamed, or, you know, they're kind of viragos. Mm. And so what you see in the very early comedies, at any rate, that he divides them. There's Catherine, who has to be tamed, and then her sweet
Kate.
Little Kate, yes, and her sweet little sister Bianca that everybody really wants to marry. But in many ways, I mean, Kate does have a lot of fire, but in the end, she's tamed in Shakespeare's play, which is horrible in my book.
And he's applauding in a way.
And he's applauding it, yes, and you can't get around that.
How old was he when he wrote that?
Oh, he's in his early 20s. He was in his very early 20s.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, he got married at 18, but then left wife and children at home and ran off to London, and so was not really with them for another 20 years. So whatever he knew about women thereafter probably came from the women in London. abandoned rather than his wife.
So he starts there, as you say, maybe all men do, but there's an arc to his understanding and his and the way he uses, if I may say that, women to light up his understanding of the human condition. Give us a sense of that arc.
Okay, so the whole arc goes more or less like this. So that in the beginning, which is the act one of my Ring cycle, it goes into five acts. It divides exactly the same way that Shakespeare's plays divide into five acts. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. But in Act One, you look at the early plays, and they're either these viragos or they're virgins on the pedestal, mm-hmm. or in the history cycle, which mm-hmm. is the other thing
the
that
Henrys
is
Henry's. Mm-hmm.
The Henry the Sixes mm-hmm. and all the other Henry plays. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, everybody's got same name.
Yeah.
What you see is that the women who take up arms, the warrior women, Joan mm-hmm. of Arc, Margaret of Anjou, they fight just the same way as men do, and they're absolutely cursed for it, you know. Then they start using their sexuality instead of their abilities
in
of
the
warriors.
Later plays.
This is in the plays. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly Shakespeare stops writing about women. And when you go into Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. he writes from the inside of women.
Mm-hmm.
Looking through Juliet's eyes. He's not writing about them. It's a huge shift. And you might ask, well, why did he shift? You know, what happened? Mm-hmm. Did he read something? Was he inspired? So this is, we don't know. Did he fall in love himself with somebody who was his equal?
Maybe he just grew up.
Maybe he just grew up.
Got to know, I mean, that's half the world and maybe more when it comes to insight.
That's true. But what you get is this huge passion then between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, they don't really see each other and they project upon mm-hmm. each other. Now, in Romeo and Juliet, you get this massive passion for each mm-hmm. other. And it's an equal passion.
Mm-hmm.
Juliet proposes to Romeo just as much as he proposes to her. She's as sexually passionate
as
he is.
It's kind of very, very out there, even now.
Even now. And when you think then, really, a young girl couldn't do anything that her father didn't say, mm-hmm. which is also in the play,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
that her father says, you don't do what I do, starve, die in the mm-hmm. streets, do mm-hmm. what you like, but mm-hmm. you're not my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she still does what she wants to do. Mm. So there's this huge equality, and it's what
through
you...
Passion.
Mm-hmm. And in that passion, Tom, there is a deep spirituality, and this is and in that spirituality you see this deep sexuality. So there's this merging of the spiritual and the sexual, and it brings Shakespeare to a new knowledge.
Does it take women to make that merger in Shakespeare's work?
It takes women and men equally to do it. It means that they both need to be totally open to each other. And you might notice that the thing as civilization for the last 2,000 years has not done is give men and women absolutely equal standing, you know, so that we really can understand each other deeply and use as much of our feminine qualities in trying to resolve the problems of the world as we do the masculine, more aggressive, linear, thou wilt do as I say, thou wilt.
And the steel will, the brand will shiver on the steel.
Or you've got bigger economic power, or you're just a psychological bully like Petruchio is, you know.
But that's interesting in its way that he's finding almost the holy in the sexual,
absolutely.
Where women are, by definition, equal partners.
Absolutely, absolutely. They're not virgins on a pedestal. They need their sexuality to be whole human beings, but so do men. And I don't mean just this kind of abrupt aggressive, you know, take mm-hmm. it and mm-hmm. just hold it. I mean, deep sexuality with mm-hmm. all the vulnerability that involves, all the courage that involves. And Shakespeare got this, and he started writing out of it. In other words, he got visceral knowledge at this point, which is one reason why you know that he's an actor, because that's what actors do, is that we understand things. They have to. Otherwise, it's not a live on stage and nobody wants to watch you. If you don't know with your body as well as your mind and your intellect, but it's the merging of those things and the fact that Shakespeare got it and then started writing out of it, and you see it in all the plays to some degree or other thereafter.
Tina Packer, we have you as not just a woman of insight, but as as an actress.
Yes.
Deliver us a line or two. Something that takes us to one of the many, many hearts, perhaps,
these are Juliet's lines when she looks at Romeo, and this is the sexual and the spiritual.
Yes.
She says to him, "My bounty is as boundless as the sea, my love as deep. The more I give to thee, the more I have, for both are infinite."
And there it is.
The
yin meets the yang. It's sort of chest to chest.
And whether you're talking about the sexuality of it being infinite, or the love being infinite, or the feeling, and that it grows the more you give.
Was that radical in Shakespeare's day, lines?
Yes.
Were there big gasps in the Globe Theater or wherever that was performed?
I think
did people just really understand that?
I think there'd been some training, in as much as during medieval Europe, we'd had the idea of the knight who was going to serve the feminine.
Yes.
But if you remember, he rides out on his horse by himself. He's going to do good deeds and protect the poor and the women.
Mm-hmm.
The woman is still a figment of his imagination. He might wear her colors, but he's not going to have sex with her. I mean, that was what Lancelot did with Guinevere, which was a no-no.
People did, because we all reproduce, so they did come face to face in that deep way then. So the audience must have known exactly what Juliet meant, even if it wasn't politically
absolutely
popular.
And we know what it means.
Of course.
It's just, are we going to accept what it means? It's one of the reasons why the plays are done all over the world. It's not just because the language is sublime, because you can't always translate the sublimity. It's because the feeling states, the knowledge that is inherent in the feeling states of what is going on stage, translates across the world. Do you understand me? Whether it's in Swahili or Chinese or what it is, that's why it's a universal thing. And when the British Empire took it all over the place, it turned against them eventually.
And we couldn't get there without the women in all those marvelous plays. Tina Packer is with us from Shakespeare and Company. Her new production is Women of Will.
We've only got to part two.
We will forge on. Who's the Shakespeare woman that speaks most pointedly to you, for you? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about Shakespeare's women with actor and director Tina Packer, who packs 10 of them into her new show, Women of Will. She means will of Will Shakespeare. She means of will power. We have a lot of callers for you already, Tina. Mary in Hamden, Connecticut. Mary, you're on the air with Tina Packer.
Hi, Tom. Great show today. Thank you so much for this topic.
Sure.
One female character who does not speak to me directly, but whom I've always been fascinated with, is Amelia from Othello. A minor character, one of the first scenes in the play, she's present and doesn't even speak.
How does she grab you then, Mary?
Well, what I find so confusing and perplexing and interesting about her is she's a minor character, has a very, officially a small role as Desdemona's house servant. She is the one in Othello who takes the handkerchief and gives it to Iago, the ocular proof that he so needs to get Othello in his snares. While she sets these wheels in motion on one level, she ultimately, at the end of the play, is the one who reveals the truth. And for me, in a play about epistemology, about knowing and about coming to know things, she's one of the characters who comes to know a great deal throughout the course of the play and ultimately brings all of the characters up to speed.
Little character Amelia in the midst of Big Othello with Desdemona and all the rest there. Mary, thank you for your call. We'll take it to Tina Packer. And Tina, not only do our listeners have their favorite women, they're not even the headliners necessarily, but the almost mute maidservant.
Right, but Mary's absolutely right. I mean, she's actually a key character, and she really illustrates well the third part of Women of Will, which is called Living Underground or dying to tell the truth.
This is from warrior women to the passionate kind of equality, spirituality, sexual merging. To living underground.
Living underground, which is the women who disguise themselves as men, or if they stay in their frocks, as Amelia and Desdemona both do, they die to tell the truth. And with Amelia, she's absolutely right. She says nothing in the first scene, hardly anything in the second scene. She steals the hanky to give to Iago in the third scene and that she's in. And in the rest of the play, the tragedy of the play rests on this blooming hanky, you know. And she, what happens is that she, and one of the questions...
Remind us, for the listeners who don't know Othello as well, well enough to know the hanky, the blooming hanky.
Okay, I shouldn't say that. It's a hanky that has strawberries on it that Othello gives to Desdemona. It's a special token that his that belonged to his mother. And so it's it's the most precious thing to him. And Desdemona loses it. In fact, Amelia steals it. And she gives it to Iago because he's asking her. And then Iago gives it to Cassio and whispers to Othello that Desdemona gave it to Cassio.
There will be betrayal.
And there is betrayal. And that's why Othello eventually kills Desdemona, because he doesn't believe his love and he doesn't believe Desdemona. So he turns away from this deep truth that Shakespeare is talking about. And he believes instead the patriarchal structure, the his fellow soldier, if you will. He doesn't, he judges Desdemona according to this old male honor thing. So he kills her.
Woman must die for the truth to come out. Is it true, they die trying to tell the truth. All right, then.
And what happens to Amelia is when she, after Desdemona has been killed, and she's a, like the battered woman, right into her death, she's saying, I didn't sleep with Cassio. I didn't, you know, as I am a Christian, I didn't do it. And he kills her even as she's saying that. And as soon as Amelia sees what she's done, what's happened with this handkerchief, she says, and there all the men are gathered around, she says, what are you talking about? I stole that handkerchief and gave it to my husband. He set this up. And the next thing that happens to her is she's killed. So she's immediately slaughtered for telling the truth. I mean, everybody says Othello's a play about racism, and it is, but it's far more about sexism in my book, than because the two women end up dead. They're both in their frocks. They both end up dead. And the third woman, Bianca, gets put in jail for something she never did, and nobody bothers to get her
out
again.
Give us a line from Othello that brings some of this to light, to our ear. Do you have one?
Yes. Well, when he's in the middle of about to kill her, he says, are you not a whore? No, as I am a Christian, if to preserve this vessel, i.e. my body, if to preserve this vessel from my Lord, from any other foul, unlawful touch, be not to be a strumpet, I am none. No, as I shall be saved. So she uses all this Christian terminology.
Everything she's got, right?
Everything she's got, and it does not save her. All her goodness, all her truth telling does not save her.
Do men have to die to tell truths in equal number?
No. Now they do sometimes, you know, and two very feminine men, if I might put it like that, who have feminine qualities, are Hamlet and Falstaff. And in the end, Hal, in order to be a hero king, has to betray Falstaff and abandon him. And Hamlet, you know, is probably the one of the most feminine of all characters, who is meant to do the honorable thing, i.e. kill the murderer of his father, but he doesn't want to do this revenge story that keeps on going on all the time. And how do we know he doesn't? Because he doesn't do it. He does it right at the end of the play, when he's in a state of almost nihilism, if I can put it like that. And then he does, and everybody ends up dead, you know. And Ophelia, she's a very classic example of a woman who stays in her frock. She tries to tell the truth about, through her madness, about what's really going on in the court and to do with sex and everything else. And, you know, she kills herself or drowns, or Gertrude allows her to drown, whatever you want to, however you want to see it. But she ends up dead through trying to tell the truth.
You've been reading and watching and acting and directing these things all the way back to the Royal Shakespeare Company now for decades. At Shakespeare and Co., in your heart of hearts, do you believe William Shakespeare gave women a fair shake?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think once he started writing from inside women, I think they actually have a better position in many ways because they are in the minority and therefore they're constantly looking at the social political structures, which the men aren't because it's fish to water for men. But through the women, you can actually see these structures that destroy women or destroy men.
Because they're disadvantaged so often because by those structures,
yeah,
they can
by
call
the
them
structure.
Out.
So that's when you start seeing that William Shakespeare himself saw the structure. So with the women who disguise themselves in the middle plays, which is the living underground bit, they disguise themselves as men so Rosalind can say what she likes about love. She can start to try and train Orlando on how to love her and how to understand it. And she finds her own voice through being dressed as a man. Do you understand me,
yes,
Tom?
Yes.
So her psyche is allowed to blossom because she's got man's clothes on. She's also, don't forget, in the forest where there are no institutional structures. Desdemona
freedom
stay,
is there.
That's right, freedom is there. Desdemona has to stay within the institutional structures of the army, and Othello is the leader of men and he's the voice of Venice in Cyprus. So he stays within the patriarchal structure, and in that structure women are not going to be able to have their full sexuality or their full voices, or nor is they going to be able to be this merging. I mean, Othello says, I loved her not wisely but too well.
Yes.
Well, that, and but Desdemona says earlier that death's unnatural that kills for loving, and that's the real statement.
Oh yes. wow that, yes. And you as a woman deep inside these characters feel as well understood by Shakespeare.
I do. I feel as if I've understood things about myself as a woman through him. And, you know, I am a feminist. And I have to tell you, I say, what would a 21st century feminist be doing with this dead white male? And Nigel Gore, my partner, says,
yes,
well, probably because he's dead and he can't answer back.
Yeah, but he answers every day. He answers every day. Let me get a call here from New York, Cambridge, New York. David, you're on the air with Tina Packer.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
My observation would be that Shakespeare lived most of his life under the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, who was clearly a very strong woman. And it's rumored or speculated that The Merry Wives of Windsor was specifically written on the request of Elizabeth. And what I observe there in The Merry Wives is the women are completely in control, and it's the men who are easily duped and deceived. And so I'm wondering what the influence of having a queen like Elizabeth might have had as Shakespeare started developing and realizing the queen was going to see his plays.
Interesting. Wonderful. Thank you, David.
I think you're absolutely right, David. I mean, the last thing Shakespeare ever wrote in Henry VIII is Cranmer's blessing over the baby Elizabeth. And he says, in her time, truth shall nurse her. Men shall eat in safety under their own vine what they plant and sing the merry songs of freedom. From her they'll learn the sacred ways of honor, and by those claim their greatness, not by blood. And then he calls her the maiden phoenix, and says, and that's the first time maiden is used in conjunction with phoenix, but that, you know, she's somebody who, when she dies, new heirs will come from her that have learnt this way of peace. So I think she was an enormous influence on not just him, but on England as a whole, that you have to find some other way of fighting wars, for instance, by negotiation rather than doing the rah-rah-rah thing. And I think that one of the reasons those early plays, you know, Henry VI's, were written was because she created a theatre company called The Queen's Men. It went all over England doing history plays, really warning people against civil war. And I think you're absolutely right. I think she loved theatre. I think she loved William Shakespeare. She loved the fat man who, Falstaff, who said all those terrible things about honour. And I think she was not only an astute political leader, but somebody who held her sexuality, because what Tom didn't say is the third meaning of women of will is will in Elizabethan English means sexuality or sexual desire or even the sexual parts. And so I'm looking for that. And I think Elizabeth is an incredible example of somebody who maneuvered with her sexuality in order to create alliances with other kingdoms and always...
No Victoria.
Yeah. No. And, you know, I don't blame her not wanting to be married. Her dad killed her mother when she was 3 years old, and then he killed her stepmother, the Good woman Lord. That was bringing her up, Catherine, when she was 7 years old. And why would she get married when men are such terrible? I mean, she clearly saw what happened to her mother and her stepmother. Why would she marry someone?
Manage your own will.
Yes.
She would turn this diamond for us of Shakespeare's women. It's so wonderful. I mean, I wonder what passage, what character or what passage makes you feel, I don't know, when you're doing these on stage, most empowered, most bereft. Give us some
Well, you know, one of the
Let us hear a bit.
Well, let me just do a bit of Cleopatra, because I'm used to doing Cleopatra.
Good.
I played Cleopatra again with Nigel, who was playing Antony at that point. But one of the things is about that I recently discovered, because that's the other thing, Thomas. I do this, I discover more things. But one of the things I discovered was how to really allow. What is surrender in love? What does surrender mean in love? And I think Antony and Cleopatra is a play about surrender, not just on a social political level, which they both eventually have to do, and the Western world went in another direction than it would have gone if they had been the rulers of the world.
Yes.
But also that in the end, Cleopatra has to surrender to Antony and who he is. Mm-hmm. So I think her greatest surrender comes in that wonderful speech, I dreamt there was an emperor, Antony. Oh, such another sleep that I might see, but such another man. His face was as the heavens, wherein stuck a sun and moon, which kept their course and lighted the little O, the earth. His legs bestrid the ocean. His reared arm crested the world. His voice was propertied as all the tuned spheres, and that to friends. But when he meant to shake and quail the world, then was he rattling thunder. For his bounty, there was no winter in it. An autumn 'twas that grew the more by reaping. In his livery walked crowns and crownets. Realms and islands were as plates dropped from his pocket. Think you there was or might be such another man as this?
And a great queen is surrendered.
Yes, yeah.
Do men surrender in this way?
Yes,
in
well, he does. Antony does.
As fully, as thoroughly?
As fully and as thoroughly, just before he
did. And yet the
did.
West went west, not east.
Yes, yes. Well, because they surrendered eventually. I mean, and they, of course, embody so many of the feminine characteristics of singing and dancing and loving and cross-dressing.
But what do you take from her speech? Do you look to it as a woman informed in your relationships with men by this speech? Is there a political interpretation you take from her surrender?
I think both of those things. You know, where his manhood was in being a Roman soldier. And
His reared arm
crested the world, you know. But on the other hand, right at the beginning of the play, he says, let Rome in Tiber melt. This is my space, i.e. Cleopatra's
with
body.
You.
Yes.
With
and,
her.
With her. Mm-hmm. This is my space. And the nobleness of life is to do thus, embracing her, that actually love is the most noble thing. Now he goes right away from that and becomes the Roman soldier and marries somebody else, but he comes back again, and then they get married as Dionysus and Isis. So those very different symbols of archetypes about womanhood, and Dionysus, of course, whom I love because he's the god of theatre, but he's also the impassioned god in his whole body. and he's the hermaphroditic god. And so there's a whole other level of the play that's going on while we're watching Egypt and Athens fall under Rome's, patriarchal legal system, armies, all those kind of things. And so where does it go? And I think this whole idea of how is it that we know the things that we know, and what are the stories that we tell, and so how are we trying to align ourselves to those stories? So knowledge and stories are two very important themes that I get to in this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Shakespeare's women with actor and director Tina Packer, who packs 10 of them into her new show, Women of Will. She means of Will Shakespeare. She means of will power. Okay, she means of will as in women's sexuality as well. And it's all there 4 centuries on. She puts it on stage at Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts. She's with us in the studio this hour. You've got some Lady Macbeth right in front of you. I wish you'd introduce us to it, the passage, and
okay.
Share.
So what happens in the fourth section is that essentially the women, and I think of this as Shakespeare's period of despair, the women don't have voices which are separate from the men's. They actually take up the male role and put all their energy behind the man and the aggressive masculine urges of the man.
As a kind of a woman in service, a daughter, Lear.
Well, it's mother in Coriolanus, wife in Macbeth. And what you see is that the country turns to fascism. So it eventually...
So when the fusion comes, you've got trouble.
You've got real trouble. If women's voices are not ameliorating men, you've got real, real trouble.
Ameliorating or at least showing the other way.
Yeah. And even then, you know, if it's the women are just ameliorating, they're not equal partners.
Right.
It's only through the sexual and the spiritual merging or living underground that we can actually have equal partnerships. And that's actually what's going to lead us out of a lot of these messes, I think,
yes,
Tom.
Yes, we hope.
In any case, this is what happens when Macbeth, the weird sister, you know, he's overcome Norway, he's a great warrior, he's become the Thane of Cawdor, and then the witches tell him he's going to be the king, and he writes to his wife and tells them, and she thinks about it and she says, yes, but she says, what thou wouldst holily, that wouldst thou... What thou wouldst highly, that wouldst thou holily, wouldst not play false, and yet wouldst wrongly win. Oh, hie thee hither, that I may pour my spirits in thine ear, and chastise with the valour of my tongue all that impedes thee from the golden round, which fate and metaphysical aid doth seem to have thee crowned withal. And then she unsexes herself in order to make sure she can do it. Come, you spirit that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty, make thick my blood, stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murthering ministers, wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief, come, thick night, and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold. And then he comes on, and she does exactly that. When he hesitates, she says, this moment onwards, this is what I'm going to account. Art thou afeared to be the same in thine own act and valour as thou art in desire? Wouldst thou have that which thou esteem'st the ornament of life, and live a coward in thine own esteem, letting I dare not wait upon I would, like a poor cat in the adage? And he socks me across the face at that point.
And unsexed is trouble.
Unsexed is real trouble. Real trouble.
And thence, sort of thenceforth, you have Shakespeare in this period of despair, men and women fused and off to fascism.
That's right. Because, well, you get a play like Timon of Athens, which is running right here in Boston, even as we speak, which is about money. And there are just a couple of whores in that. There's no voice ameliorating Timon's spending of money and then losing all his money. And very much.
Does he ever look back in the words of his characters to say, oh, you know, sex me again?
No. That's why it's hardly ever done. But Coriolanus is the most alarming example of this, where the mother sends Caius Marcius, her son, to war at 11, and he becomes a killing machine. And he's an incredible warrior, but he has no idea of other people's humanity whatsoever. And in the end, when he turns against Rome, he's going to kill his mother, his wife, who never said boo to a goose, and his 11-year-old kid. And he's, he's going to lay the whole of Rome to waste.
But what does it mean? Did Shakespeare then give up on women, on that power that he saw in to actually ameliorate, to actually balance the world in a different way?
I think by this time, James was on the throne. Elizabeth was not on the throne. And not that James fancied himself as a peacemaker as well, but I think the whole situation was going somewhere that Shakespeare didn't necessarily like very much. But I think it also had to do with his personal life, that things were happening in his personal life. Because when he goes into the last section, when he comes out of this despair, because Lear, if you remember, the two oldest daughters are very masculine in what it is that they want, in the last period, which I call the daughter redeems the father, the maiden phoenix, is all about the sins of the fathers being redeemed by their daughters. And Shakespeare went back to Stratford at that point and became reacquainted with his own daughters, who had been babies when he left them, and they're now 20, 21,
and maybe some
22.
Sucker there.
And you know, maybe he was sick, and maybe Susanna, his eldest daughter, was married to John Hall, the greatest healer of the age. And, you know, so...
So how does it feel as an actress to go into these later phases, you know, where women become sort of, they're unsexed, they become in a way tool of the man's ambition, they're fused in that ambition?
Yeah.
I mean, is it a dark passage to take?
It's very dark. It's very dark. And we actually, that's the longest section of any play that we do. In Women of Will, we do about 15 or 20 minutes. We go from the top of the play right to the end of the play, because what you see then is the absolute, not just despair of Lady M, because, of course, she goes mad and she's washing her hands all the time and she's trying to get rid of all the guilt. But he now is a killing machine. He says, I'm in blood so far. It was as tedious to go back as it was to go forward. And, you know, I'm going to keep on acting without any reflection. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do.
There's no break.
So you see how this kind of violence ends up in more violence and psychic death and that it takes generations for it to recover. And one of the questions that I want to ask in the thing is, why do we keep on telling this revenge story, Tom? Why is it? I mean, it's from the founding of Western civilization, from the Iliad to the Odyssey. It's all about, you know, men going on these valiant, heroic journeys which end up in death and despair, and women ending up dead. And we're still telling it on CNN every night.
What are you telling it or actually enacting it? What's your
and
complaint?
Enacting it. Well,
but you're an actor, so you're doing the telling. Okay. You're staging it. You're keeping the story.
I think one of the reasons that we keep on enacting it and therefore telling the story of it, although I think a lot of people are really seriously trying to change the story, and I think Shakespeare tried to change the human story.
Shakespeare's help, because he reveals it to us.
That's right. And in the late plays, that's what he does. He changes the story where there is redemption at the end and the daughters can get the sins of the fathers forgiven. But I think why we do it is because we have separated our minds from our bodies. And from the early time of the Christian church, although it began in Greece as well, I have to say that, when women were completely dismissed, there were no women The women had nothing to do with the creating of any of our institutions that we've lived off ever since. Mm-hmm. The academe, the gymnasium, the religious institutions, the law. Women were dismissed to their houses. They didn't even have names
properly.
So your
women of will, did he try and crack them back into the middle of that?
Well, he does try. But what happened is, ever since, you know, early Christianity, really, since Augustine, we have been aligning our linear thinking, our head thinking with power, which is what he did with the church and the Church of Rome. And we have been cutting off our bodies. And what you know as an actor or as any artist is that real knowledge comes out of the body. It comes out of the deepest part of yourself. And we have to put the mind and body back together
again. Did he give that to women or did he give it equally
He gave it equally to men, which is what happens at the end of Antony and Cleopatra, which is what happens when in the late plays, you know, so Tempest will take that because that's so Prospero is out for revenge. You know, he's got his enemies there to do terrible things to him. But his creative spirit, Ariel, says, I would forgive them. If I were human, I would forgive them. And his own daughter is in love with now he wants that, but she's in love with Ferdinand. And Ferdinand and Miranda meet on this very sexual, spiritual merging kind of level. She woos him just as much as he woos her. And they meet on that level, and then they're going to go back and try and take over the kingdoms. So hopefully they'll restart this story. And you see very clearly, you know, one's going back to serve the social political structure, but in love and with love. And the other is freed at the end, Ariel. He frees his creative spirit. So they, between them, they redeem Prospero. Winter's Tale is even more that, you know. And in Winter's Tale, because the father... Leontes has killed his wife, his eldest son has died, and it's his daughter that he hoped he'd killed as well, thrown out onto the hillside. She comes back, and through the man she loves, Florizel, he stands with her and rejects his father's kingdom. And so they stand for love, and together they bring all the pieces back together again, and everybody can forgive each other, together with the witch Paulina.
Do you hear Shakespeare calling on women in these lines to fulfill a kind of a destiny or to fill a need here? Or does he call on... Because it's kind of the feminine, in part, that you point out earlier, at the heart of a lot so much artistry that he's calling on. Right. Here, is he calling on women or men and women equally?
First of all, he puts the artist on stage in these late plays as well. So there's a lot about the role of artists. Mm-hmm. But yes, he's calling on men and women equally to align themselves to a deeper way of knowing things. So we have hundreds and millions of experts on things, but they don't know it with their bodies. They know it with their intellect. So you can't solve a lot of these problems, Tom, through intellectual things. You've got to solve them through compassion and through relationships and through changing the very ethos in which we live. And we're not going to save the planet if we don't all understand that we're killing the planet, you know. But everything, all our media, in fact, now creates separation because it's all about titillation. It's about, you know, I mean, what are we looking at? We're looking at the things that titillate our senses. So we look at this violence, and we've got video games where the violence is being enacted at all. We're never looking at the consequences of that and what this does to people's deepest souls. And we don't want to look at it because it's uncomfortable.
We're trying to weave it together right here, right now, and more days than one. I don't want to ignore the women beating on our door. Kate, no less, in Providence, Rhode Island. Kate, you're on the air with Tina Packer.
Hi, I'm so excited to see the production. And actually, I worked for years with your theater partner, Nigel Gore. We ran a theater in Rhode Island.
Kate. Yes, I know who you are.
And we did... I wanted to ask you about, I'm stepping back into despair, I'm afraid, but the Lady Macbeth and the despair that comes from her body, in that after the unsex me here, you know, she says that I've given suck and know how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me, and I would, while it was smiling, have, you know, dashed if you break your vow to me.
Yeah.
And there's this baby that she references that's never spoken of again.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you think about that, because to me it's sort of like she makes this bargain with the spirits. Like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah. Well, not only that, Kate, and I know you played this with Nigel, so I don't know where you came out on it. But not only that, I just I feel that the baby that died is one of the keys to what's going on, you know, that in fact that was a time of enormous tenderness and hope for them. And because the baby died in some way, that's left a huge absence in this relationship. And this is one of the ways which she can get the intimacy back in the relationship, or that she's then important to him again. And she sees it as a way to become key to his life again, that she's the one who can make sure that he's king. And then she thinks it's going to be the greatest thing on God's earth. But of course, the very opposite happens. They get separated from each other. He sleeps no more. He goes further and further into alchemy, the witch's kind of power. And then, of course, he becomes a killing machine, and he doesn't care who he kills. He only cares about survival. And so that separates them completely. So she, by doing what she does, she's not able to, she doesn't achieve any of the things, and it's because she takes on the masculine role. You know, she loses her truest inner self, and you know, it's so tragic. It's so tragic. I mean, I find it devastating to play it. I don't know how you found it, but I find it devastating to play it.
Kate, thank you so much for your call. We have only a minute and a half, and it is not enough time. Oh, what's the question? What is the question? I mean, you've played so many of these. What do you end up hearing Shakespeare telling you as a woman, as an actor, an actress? You know, what?
Well,
what's the message? Maybe you speak back to him.
No, the first thing I felt him saying to me is, Tina, you have to stop. You have to stop running an arts organization and being in the office every day. You've got to get back into your body.
On that stage.
Because,
in
the body. And you've got to do it, you know. But I think that all great artists, not just Shakespeare, but all great artists eventually are trying to say this. And I think all of us artists, and all of those of us who are in the arts in whatever form, whether it's music, whether it's painting, whatever it is, have got to become more active. We have to. And so what I'm really trying to do, even though I've backed off from running the organization, I'm really trying to put my art out there and be as brave as I can in saying what it is that I think and feel. And it's just, you know, it's just... It's a life's work, Tom. What can I say?
Well, we are very glad that it is back on the stage. Tina Packer, founding artistic director of Shakespeare & Company in Lenox, Massachusetts. The show is Women of Will through July 24th. It's been fabulous having you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.